As you're well aware, votes are still being counted in key battleground states, which could determine the outcome of the presidential election. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump's campaign filed lawsuits yesterday in Michigan, Pennsylvania, to stop the counting of ballots in those states, demanding more access to observe the tallying process. Democratic nominee Joe Biden urged patience as the vote tally continues. Are you surprised by the results so far? Do you think the unofficial results are likely to hold, or will this chaotic 2020 bring even more surprises? We're at 800-642-1234. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta and a political analyst. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, your timing is impeccable because we could use some context right now on what your state of Georgia, what's happening there. What can you tell us?
So the count isn't over. We will expect to hear a little bit more from Fulton County, which is the biggest county in the state. It's where Atlanta is at around 11 a.m. Eastern time. As the count is going on, we're seeing President Trump's lead shrink. So as of early this morning, it was about a half a percentage point lead. But even during the overnight period, we had seen Vice President Biden gain on President Trump by a few thousand votes.
And Georgia hasn't backed a Democrat since 1992. Clinton, who had won by less than 1% in that first term race against George H.W. Bush. What can you tell us about the makeup of Georgia?
Well, I mean, Georgia has changed a lot since 1992. And so that explains why we're seeing this now. I mean, and I should point out that part of the reason why Clinton won in 92 was because Ross Perot was on the ballot that year. Georgia has become more racially and ethnically diverse. The Democratic Party has become stronger. In the state, they're better at organizing, kind of inspired and led by Stacey Abrams. They have identified voters of color and young people who they believe are you know, good Democratic targets. They've made sure that they're registered to vote. And then they've done outreach to make sure that they turn out to vote. And those efforts over time, just coupled with changing demographics that favor Democrats over Republicans, has pushed Georgia to being competitive. I'm not surprised that it's competitive. And without saying who the winner of the election is going to be, like, you know, it was, I always had a hunch that it was going to be decided by a point or two. Maybe it's going to be less than a point. That's what it looks like this time.
So you're not as surprised by what you're seeing in Georgia, in your state. Anything surprising you going on around the rest of the nation that we're seeing razor-thin margins in a few battleground states?
I can't say that I'm surprised by that either. And I think especially given how narrow the margins were in your state and in Michigan next door in 2016, I think we should have been prepared for a narrow margin and for it to possibly slip. I mean, I think the big question that people are going to talk about when this is all done is, but the poll said that the margins were going to be more comfortable. And so, you know, I want to wait to see what the final sort of vote tallies look like and if you compare them to what pollsters were saying. So, I mean, there will be some discussion of that afterwards. So perhaps that's a small surprise. But at the end of the day, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that if Trump could, you know, win, you know, Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania by about 77,000 votes in 2016, that if Joe Biden were to reclaim them, it was probably also going to be by a small margin.
Well, you said the P word, the poll word, and, you know, the polls, they just, you know, were wrong about 2016. And once again, we're scratching our heads at what the polls said and what the outcomes look like. Should we be putting our stock in polling? I mean, is polling worth it?
I am a defender of public opinion. You know, I think we need to take a more measured view and a more realistic view about what polls are telling us. And I think we should use polls more for other types of purposes, not just trying to predict horse races. Mm. So I think that, you know, is part of what's going on. We spend all of our time on the horse race. But one, I mean, we tend to think that if a poll says that Biden is going to get 51% of the vote or 55% of the vote, that's what we're going to see in real life. No, that's just the midpoint of a certain range of possible answers that the, you know, sort of real population could reflect. And, you know, I think that there are some legitimate questions about some of the stuff falling outside of the confidence intervals that are set by the margin of error. But we'll just have to wait to see what these final votes look like. And then we can see what that looks like. The other thing that, you know, I think, you know, we'll have to look at is see how far off the final national tally is from the national polls. So, you know, I think we've known that sometimes it's been a lot easier to predict the popular vote than it is to try to predict the state vote.
Yeah. Andra Gillespie with us, associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta, where she's watching Georgia unfold right now. We're looking at her state and across the nation in this analysis. With your insights as well, what do you think made the difference in this race? Was it the pandemic or racial injustice? Was it the economy? What weighed heaviest on your mind as you cast your ballot? And what do you see unfolding where you are? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Andra, it seems that with the pandemic raging here in Wisconsin and in other states, that can't take a back seat to what happened at the polls and how people voted. What do you make of the pandemic's influence in all of this?
Well, if we look at the exit polls, those who thought that the pandemic was their top issue were overwhelmingly likely to support Joe Biden for president. The issue is that the most cited issue or the issue that people tended to cite as their most important issue by a plurality was the economy. Mm. And there, the polls, the exit polls look different. And so what I found myself doing is I was looking at this by nationally and state by state, was that I would look at the top issues and I would look at the proportion of people who said the economy was their top issue and then looked at the people who said race or COVID was their top issue and then add them together to see whether or not racial justice or coronavirus voters were more numerous in whatever sample I was looking at than those who said that the economy was more important. And when I saw that, right, since the break tended to be strongly, very strongly for Biden, that was when I could say this state is probably going to end up, you know, being a Biden state as opposed to a Trump state. So I think probably the big takeaway is that while COVID is in fact important to a lot of people, the economy, which is clearly related to, which is clearly related to the COVID crisis, is more important for more people. I mean, it's more important just because more people cite that as an issue.
And it's so hard, I would say, to compartmentalize these issues because they are so connected with each other. Economy connected to the pandemic and, you know, racial injustice, police brutality in there as well. So, you know, to me, it would be very difficult for you to even try to figure out how do you parse this? How do you make sense of what issues really matter the most?
Yeah, I mean, and in the exit poll, just as I'm pretty sure the survey takers asked the question, they were asked to pick one. Uh-huh. I don't know if there was a subsequent question that would have asked them to register a second issue.
Yeah.
There will be other surveys that are in the field or are soon to be fielded by academics that will get greater granularity and will allow people to sort of think about more than one issue, and where we can certainly ask what respondents' attitudes are about a range of issues and then model it together where we can see how they all interact sort of, you know, in competition with each other. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes in particular, we can figure out how to interact with them and see sort of, you know, what people who care about the economy and coronavirus, you know, are thinking and how they're behaving. But yeah, one of the limitations of the polls is that we can't study what we don't ask. And so it wasn't asked in a particular way to help us elicit that answer.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, our guide to the vote tallying to this election. And we'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're continuing our look at the 2020 election here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We don't know the results of the presidential race, but this year it brought us some firsts in diversity and representation in politics. People from underrepresented backgrounds were elected to office. Democrat Sarah McBride became the country's first openly transgender state senator. Republican Madison Cawthorn became the youngest person elected to Congress at age 25. Black, transgender, Latino, and openly gay congressional candidates did make history. So what candidates' rise stands out to you? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Emory University political analyst Andra Gillespie, who stays with us for the hour. Let's bring in Logan now, joining us from Green Bay with thoughts on the election. Hi, Logan. What are you thinking?
Hi. I think the support for Trump was inelastic. I'm using an economic term. Doesn't matter what the factors were, the supporters would have remained with him. And we found him repugnant, and so did the world. But the support for him hasn't shifted much. He has a cult-like following, and that is why I think it didn't make any difference. Of course, Biden did a little better so far, but Trump still has his supporters.
Let's get Andra to respond to that President Trump's supporters followed him at every turn, and that it didn't matter what the candidate would do, he still had that base.
So I think in many ways what the results bear out is that while both candidates clearly grew their base because this was record turnout, they were speaking to the exact same people that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were speaking to in 2016. This is not a repeat of 2016, so I want to be clear about saying that. But in the same way that President Trump didn't grow his base, really, I mean, we could talk about ways on the margins that you see, you know, increases amongst African Americans, which are not unusual in second term elections. We could look at the outreach towards African American men, which looks like it was marginally successful, but, you know, again, isn't historically unprecedented. But it deepened and doubled down on the base, and they turned out in higher numbers because of outreach. And then that was matched by the Democrats deepening into their own base and then making sure that they turned out in high numbers. And so what we still see is a deeply divided America. What many people are pointing out is that, you know, if Joe Biden wins this election, it's not coming with a Democratic takeover of the Senate. So right now, the Democrats are at a net gain of one, and we'll see whether or not they can actually get the four that they need to take over the chamber outright. And then when we look in the House, we've seen actually moderate Democrats be seriously embattled in this election, with many of them losing, with a few of them, so about five so far, losing congressional races.
We're talking with Andra Gillespie, who teaches at Emory University, and she's our guide to the aftermath of the 2020 election, taking your reactions as well. What do you think of the results so far? Do you think the unofficial results are likely to hold, or do you think that we are in for a long road here? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's join us now. Let's bring in Phil from Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil. What are your observations?
Hi. I'm very interested in the outcome of the election, but I'm almost more interested in the process by which people use to evaluate their choices for candidates in elections. I see the economy as being one which is won conceptually by Republicans in voting, and I can't understand that. Clinton left office with a surplus coming out of a debacle from the previous president, and Obama took George Bush's economy from a collapse in 2008 to an outstanding recovery in 2016. So I'm just perplexed. I would like to know your guest's response to why she thinks the Republicans have been able, in our supposedly well-educated electorate, to own the economy.
Andra?
Well, I mean, if we look at certain certain figures, they work in Donald Trump's favor. So Donald Trump was able to build on the Obama economy, and we saw unemployment continue to decline to historically low levels before the pandemic. And then if we look at increases in income, there were increases in income. And then there are people who look at the stock market, whether or not that's a good barometer, you know, I'll leave to you. And so when they look at those changes, they do actually believe that, you know, America was better off under Trump. I also don't think that we have completely dispelled the mystique of Trump's business acumen because of his work in real estate or because of his stint hosting The Apprentice on television. And so there were are people who still actually view him as a strong leader, too. So that was one of the interesting kind of trait questions that was on the exit poll. People who, one, were looking for a strong leader broke overwhelmingly for Trump. And so I think, you know, what people's definition of leadership is and what people's definition of in terms of what economic fundamentals are important look like they are predictive of vote choice.
You mentioned The Apprentice. Do you think celebrity endorsements had any effect on the campaign or on the campaign trail, the race?
You know, that remains to be seen. Most people made up their minds about who they were going to vote for well before Election Day. One of the things that was interesting in the polls was that if you made up your mind basically in the summer, you were more likely to vote for Trump. So Trump supporters were Trump supporters regardless, and they stayed there. To get back to the first caller's question, people who made up their minds, you know, in September broke for Biden, and then people who made up their minds in the last week or in the last few days also ended up breaking for Trump. And so I don't know if that's conflicted people who made up their minds, and you know we will have to speculate, and it's, the other surveys are going to have to answer this question. Was it Amy Coney Barrett for African-American men? Was it, you know, Ice Cube and Lil Wayne? We don't know, but we have to consider that very few people made up their minds in the last week. The overwhelming majority of the electorate knew who they were voting for well before last week.
So what about taxes and tax breaks? How might that affect the outcome and, you know, what people see in terms of what they pay into the federal government? Oh, where does that fall in the line of importance?
So the exit polls are not reporting any questions based on taxes.
Okay.
It's really hard to speak to that question. I think perhaps getting back to your caller asked the question about the economy. I think we still have to figure out what the long-term implications are of the president's tax policy, particularly with respect to deficit spending, because that hasn't been discussed just yet. And so we've seen, you know, deficits balloon. I mean, in part, because right now, in terms of having to deal with the crisis, there has to be a lot of federal outlay, which is totally understandable. But the tax cuts also contributed to the deficit. And so we're going to have a discussion about spending at some point in the future. And so I think it's a question of whether or not Trump tax policies, you know, actually are brought up in the context of that discussion in the future and how we will actually end up judging them in the long term.
Well, we certainly saw it in the TV ads leading up to the election in terms of the ads targeting Biden, saying Biden is going to raise your taxes. So we certainly saw it there in the political advertising.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly saw that that claim. But again, I can't test it with the information that I have now.
Sure.
And then there's also the context of who was likely to get their taxes raised and whether or not everyday Americans interpreted that as affecting them. So, you know, most people feel pretty certain that, you know, a Biden administration would propose a tax increase for people in the higher income strata. So, you know, people making, you know, above $400,000, $450,000 a year. And so do Americans, you know, making $75,000 a year still interpret that as a tax increase, or do they think that they're next as a result of it? I think, you know, is going to be the ultimate question when we're thinking about those issues. But we also have to think about this in the context of, you know, what's going to be divided partisan control of the legislature. So even if Democrats wanted to raise taxes, you still have to get that through Mitch McConnell's Senate right now, assuming that Republicans are still in control of that chamber.
Yeah. So it's not, you know, if you're pushing specific policies, you still have to get it through the House and the Senate and then see what it looks like after that, if it gets through.
Right. Right.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie is our guide to the 2020 election with insights on absorbing what's transpired in the past 48 hours now, right? How to interpret results. Should one of the candidates concede the race right now? Or do you want your candidate to fight for every last vote? What do you think of the protests breaking out around the country about counting ballots? What do you think made the difference in this race? What weighed heaviest in your mind as you cast your ballot? Be part of this conversation. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up with Andra Gillespie right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a note here on our programming plans. As votes in the presidential election continue to be counted, we will be airing tonight at 8 an NPR election update special with the latest news from around the country here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can follow developments as well, including Wisconsin election results at WPR.org. Right now, there are millions of votes left to be counted, and that's not abnormal. The Washington Post journalists write that close races often take days or weeks to settle. In most states, vote counts aren't official until weeks after Election Day. Did you have any problems voting? What reforms would you like to see in how our country conducts elections? Were you surprised President Trump improved his standing among Latino voters in at least two swing states? Join in with your observations, your questions, 800-642-1234. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University, and she's our guide. Andra, we heard from Mary in Menominee, emailed wondering about international votes and which may come in later or even next week. And Mary is asking, how do these votes get counted, or do they get counted? What happens with votes overseas?
Every vote will get counted, and that's normal. So, you know, you expect that overseas votes would have to arrive by Election Day and that they would get counted. I think there are I hope I'm remembering this correctly. There are special allowances from military, especially if they're coming in from military bases. So they're going to wait to receive those votes, and then they're going to count them equally. But elections officials know how many votes are outstanding. And so when they're starting to make projections, as they did in Wisconsin, knowing that there were still votes outstanding, they felt comfortable making the call that they did because the number of outstanding votes is actually less than the margin by which, in your case, Joe Biden is actually up in the state. So, you know, I think people are being really cautious in reporting things out and trying to be transparent and telling you how many votes are still left. But what they're saying is that they've counted everything that they have, and they don't anticipate so many more votes coming in that it could possibly change the outcome of the result.
Right. So they have a really good sense on exactly how many votes are outstanding, still left to be counted, and making sure they have that very clear number in front of them.
Yes.
Let's bring in Cindy now in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, as much as I despise Trump and I want him gone, I really think we should not make any concessions either way until all the votes are counted. And let's face it, the Electoral College doesn't even convene until, what, December 14th or December 18th, something in there. And we are a society that has to have things right now, right now, right now. It's time we start relaxing, letting the process work like it's supposed to work, and make sure that every vote is counted. And I don't like the fact that these states call even though they're supposedly, you know, assured that's not going to change, I don't think anyone should call anything until all the votes have been counted in each state.
Cindy, thank you for that. Be patient, she is saying, and taking more scrutiny here on the process of calling states early, Andra.
Yeah, so there's a lot that I identify with the previous caller. I haven't quite said it this way, but I think that we do live in a society of instant gratification, and we feel that we have to know. And some of that is normal. I mean, we've been building up to this moment for, you know, all year for sure, and for some people since the last election. So we really do want to know what happened. But at the same time, I think we're going to have to control our impulses and control our anxieties. And so as adults, if you've heard about the experiment where you put the marshmallow in front of the four-year-old and you tell them they can't eat it, right? We're not that four-year-old with the marshmallow. We are actually supposed to have to understand what deferred gratification is and to be able to wait. So we should be doing that. Our leaders should be modeling that behavior. And so, you know, if we think back to, you know, the times before Telegram and the times before television, when people had to ride on horses to go vote, which is why we have Election Day on Tuesday to give you a day to get to your polling location. Folks would have to wait for the next newspaper to show up to let them know who the election is. So if our forebears in the 19th century could wait days to find out election results, I think we can too.
Amazing context there, Andra. So, you know, speaking of early, Florida comes to mind, and President Trump was able to win Florida in part by carrying 55% of Cuban American voters and 30% of Puerto Ricans. Why did he do so much better among Latinos in Florida than, say, Arizona or New Mexico?
Well, I mean, first, we have to acknowledge that Cuban Americans break Republican in terms of their identification. That's been a hallmark of the study of Latino politics. We've known that for years. So we shouldn't be surprised at all that Cuban Americans broke for Donald Trump. They are an historically Republican voting bloc. And so that dates back to how the Democratic Party treated them when they first arrived in Miami, their interpretation of President Kennedy's failed policy towards Cuba, especially with respect to the Bay of Pigs. So, I mean, and keep in mind, you know, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, two Republican senators, you know, are both Cuban American, and that like totally makes sense. Now, granted, Bob Menendez is also Cuban from New Jersey, and he's a Democrat, but it's you know, that is the one sort of large Latino subgroup in the United States that we expect to vote Republican. And in part, you know, when we're thinking about looking at these high numbers of Latino Republicans, we need to remember that African-Americans are about 10% Republican. But that's not true, actually, amongst Latinos. So if you see about 30% of the population voting Republican, it's because they're Republican, and so you would expect them to vote their party identification. The larger question I think we're going to ask with the exit polls, and they're not going to report this, so I would actually have to wait for it to become publicly available in a really long time, is to look at levels of religiosity.
Oh.
And what type of religious identification, and so in particular what I would want to see amongst non-Cuban Latinos is whether or not they identify as evangelical Protestants, because that's where you're likely to see some differences in voting behavior.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be really interesting, too, because we haven't even touched on religion and what that has to do with the election. And certainly in the past, you know, the Catholic vote, for instance, has come up. What have you seen there with religion and the polls? I'm sorry, well, and the race and the outcome?
Well, I mean, you know, most exit polls will report whether or not somebody identifies as a white evangelical.
Okay.
And so that's the data that we have on hand right now. And so white evangelicals actually voted slightly less for Trump this time. I mean, it's still very strongly Republican in their voting behavior, but it was 76% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. That was about 80 or 81%, if I recall, from 2016. So we do see this slight contraction that actually puts it back at what it would be kind of considered normal white evangelical voting rates for Republican candidates. And, you know, this is part of the reason why you've seen Donald Trump make certain overtures to evangelical communities, so in particular the judges that he's appointed to the federal judiciary, including the Supreme Court justices, and, you know, moving, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moving the embassy there. These were all done with an eye towards keeping white evangelicals within the Republican fold. So, you know, we're going to be disentangling who some of the defections were. You know, it was a change on the margins. So, you know, this is still a very, very solidly Republican voting bloc, and they still remain incredibly loyal to the president.
Andra Gillespie is author of the book Race in the Obama Administration, political scientist at Emory University in Atlanta, unpacking for us what she sees in this 2020 election. Getting your insights as well, your questions for Andra, 800-642-1234. We have an email here asking you, Andra, how different voter turnout might have been if the polls had more accurately reflected the actual results. No real way of knowing that, but interesting question.
So I may invert the question a little bit.
Okay.
So we know that canvassing is the best way to increase voter turnout. The first study that was in a series of studies that helped to really establish this in the modern era, in this century, also looked at what type of message one needs in order to increase voter turnout. And so they used mailers, and mailers had different messages. So one would have said, you know, vote for neighborhood solidarity, right, to help your neighbors out. This is going to be good for the community. One, you know, said, you know, it's your patriotic duty. So it included sort of a picture of soldiers in World War II putting up the flag at Iwo Jima. And I believe one also said, you know, do it because the election is close. And what they found was that in all three of these groups compared to a control group, the voter turnout rates were basically the same and slightly higher than what the control group had. So the initial conclusion was that the message doesn't matter. Subsequent studies have suggested that the messenger matters. You can shame people into voting. So, for instance, if you've gotten there were the ones that came from foreign entities and that were threatening and, you know, should be ignored and decried. But if you've ever gotten a letter that tells you, we know that you vote more than people in this neighborhood or less than people in this neighborhood, that inducement of just letting you know that, like, your voting record is public and can be monitored is something that can increase your likelihood of turning out to vote. So they're trying to shame you into voting. I would focus more on the mobilization efforts. And so if I had to think about the counterfactual here, and people smarter than I am are probably going to try to model this, and I'm just going to read and enjoy their work. what I would be paying attention to is whether if the Democrats had actually gone out and canvassed and knocked on doors, which they were loath to do because of the pandemic, would we have seen a different turnout? And that's crazy to think about in a record-breaking turnout year. But yeah, would things have looked a little bit different if Democrats had responded to Republicans going out on the doors to make sure that they went out on the doors as well? I mean, I think it's the question that we're always going to be asking in the back of our minds.
Food for thought from Emory University political analyst Andra Gillespie, giving us some clarity in this hyper-partisan election cycle. Still time to talk. We had heard from caller Tyler asking us so acutely the other day, do we want to bridge the partisan divide? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie. It is a razor-thin path to the White House. We know that now. Biden, in a press conference yesterday afternoon, struck a presidential tone when he said if he is eventually elected, he will govern as an American president. President Trump's campaign has contested the vote count tallying in Michigan and Pennsylvania. What do you make of 2020? 800-642-1234. Andra, something we haven't talked about quite yet is the role of younger voters, first-time voters. What did we learn there?
So if we're looking overall at who participated in the election, We'll see that older voters are still the numerically larger group. So right now, the exit poll is weighted at voters who are age 45 and older, comprising 60% of the electorate, compared to 40% for those 18 to 24. If we look at the first-time voters, they make up about 13% of the electorate. And in particular, if we're going to look at voters who are aged 18 to 29, we are looking at is that that comprises about 17% of the electorate. So, you know, even though millennials and Gen Z are poised to overtake baby boomers in the population and in the electorate, it's going to take time to integrate them into politics and bring them up to their full participation levels. That's actually a hallmark of American politics. It's in part the hallmark of the life cycle. So younger people participate less in politics because they know less about it, you know, might be young and irresponsible. But that same flaky 19-year-old, you know, could very easily turn into a responsible
37-year-old voter. Did you just say flaky?
Yes.
I'm sure you haven't seen any of them. You have not seen any of those in your classroom, just to clarify.
they would never tell me. But, I mean, I do actually say it in precisely this way when I talk to my students. And, yeah, I'm sure some people bristle or they may chuckle if I can say it in a humorous way. But, you know, the truth is that those students who I may teach at 18 or 19 or 20 years old, I think that I have the more participatory group just because they're taking my class. But between them and their classmates, their participation levels will improve as they get older. So, you know, as they turn 30, 35 and get jobs and get married and buy houses, you know, they'll become responsible voting citizens. But you can't expect the probability of an 18-year-old voter to be as high as the probability of a 50-year-old voter.
What about the get out the vote rallies and those drives that we saw amid the pandemic? Did those have an effect on the election?
So I view rallies as being sort of important for earned media. And I think it was really important for President Trump. So because quiet has kept Vice President Biden, you know, outraged President Trump. And so as, especially in places where they had to make decisions about removing ad buys, being able to show up in a community and get free television advertising was essential. That's part of what's going on. You know, the other part of what's going on, sort of aside from the president's own personal needs, would be, you know, exciting a base of volunteers who could then be used to go out and do canvassing work, to do phone banking. I mean, one thing that the Trump campaign has done because of the pandemic, I didn't go out to rallies this year, but I did go to Trump rallies in during the 2016 cycle. They tended to be very astute about trying to collect information from people, having voter registration available there, and then using, I'm presumably using that information later. So if you can gather information on attendees and then use that to follow up with them to make sure that they turn out to vote, to make sure that they're registered to vote, they're effective. But by themselves, rallies don't vote. And I think it's really important to put that out there.
So I want to look closer here at Congress. Democrats were hoping to regain control of the Senate. They were able to flip seats in Arizona and Colorado, lost one in Alabama, others too close to call. You know, the Senate remains in Republican control. Are we in for another couple years at least of gridlock?
I mean, I think, you know, we have to prepare for Joe Biden not necessarily having the mandate that I think many Democrats would have hoped that he would have. And I think that there's still going to be a debate within the Democratic camp about whether to take a more moderate tone or whether to take a more progressive tone. You know, we've seen moderates in the House in particular take a beating. And so whether it was moderate Republicans retiring because they thought they saw a bloodbath on the wall, or moderate Democrats who are in very close races, some of which they will lose, right? There's a question of whether or not, you know, President Trump's attacks on the Republican Party, attacks on the Democratic Party as being socialist, are going to make it difficult to keep a Democratic majority in place. You know, I think the other thing that we're going to have to look at, I'm going to need more time to go through the data, is to look at what the vote looks like. I think many people thought that President Trump was going to be a down ballot drag.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that, you know, you can look at to see whether or not that's true is to see how many votes the Republican Senate incumbents were getting in their elections relative to the president. So, you know, especially if they're getting more votes in absolute numbers than President Trump, or they're getting a higher proportion of votes than President Trump, that suggests that there's still incumbency advantage and that there was still some personal vote, so that even if people didn't vote for Donald Trump, they may not have necessarily voted for Joe Biden and then come and voted Republican, you know, in the Senate election, but that the Republicans had their own staying power. And so I think that, you know, we need to acknowledge that. And then figure out sort of, you know, how, you know, what to observe from there. And for Democrats in particular, they're going to have to figure out how they work with, you know, their Republican colleagues and whether or not obstruction really is the most helpful path forward.
Talking with Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta, where Georgia is still in a very close race, too close to call. Andra giving us context this hour and taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Teresa now from McFarland. Hi, Teresa. What's on your mind?
Hi. I kind of get upset with the polls, because when I was mailed a Republican poll, I felt like saying, yes, I'm going to vote for Trump, just to put the Trump people at ease, when I never in the world would think of voting for Trump. But I hate this when they say that Biden is ahead. Who answered the polls? Did they answer him truthfully? I mean, there's so much room for someone taking advantage of these polls, and how do they know how accurate they are? I just don't trust them at all. And Yeah, I was just very leery, and I didn't even like to hear that Biden was ahead, because I thought, that's not, you know, who says it's true?
Yeah, so Teresa, you know, not trusting polls, Andra, and there was some speculation about shy Trump voters. Do you expect there will be changes to how polls are done?
I mean, we can't change social desirability effects. You can just try to figure out a way to ask questions discreetly so that people feel comfortable answering them honestly. And so the notion of the shy voter is basically sort of a version of what we call the Bradley effect, when we were looking at black candidates in the 1980s who would do better in surveys than they would do in actual election results. And what we thought was happening was that people were saying that they were voting for these candidates, Tom Bradley in California or Doug Wilder in Virginia, in the 1980s, and then people would go into the voting booth and do something different on election day. So, you know, a couple of things to look at. If the shy vote really is related to Trump overperforming in places where you would expect him to overperform, then I would suspect that that really doesn't have anything to do with people lying to pollsters. We could look at the very few undecideds who were left who ended up breaking for Trump at the last minute. That could possibly sort of explain some of the difference, but I think the bigger culprit that we're all going to be looking at is what the sampling looks like, and in particular, how polls were weighted. So, you know, we get a random sample. It's supposed to, as best as possible with a smaller group of people, reflect the overall population. But because people don't answer surveys all the time, the demos usually don't come out sort of perfectly representative of what we think the population is. And so pollsters often wait, so they'll give slight added value to people from groups that come out underrepresented in polls. So I think we'll be looking at that. And so what happened in 2016 was we didn't talk to enough non-college graduates. And so we'll just look at which demographic looks like they were underrepresented in polls first. That's where I think they'll probably look first and try to explain what happened.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University and a political analyst, teaches courses on African-American politics, political participation, and race in elections. Just ahead, it is 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.